medical systems are decades old. According to some estimates, we cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
Why is there? I saw the Iraqi soldiers coming to the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
What's up, y'all? Welcome to the What Is Truth podcast. I am your host, Wheezy, and I am doing rather exquisite on this fine Saturday as I am joined by the great and powerful Mr. Don Jeffries. How are you, sir?
Okay, glad to be with you.
Awesome to have you on. You are an author of several books, including the book Hidden History. For those that may not be too familiar with your work, if you can give us a little bit of background, how you got started and all that good jazz.
Well, I was always a writer. From the time I was a kid, I was writing stories and poems and later started writing songs. So I was always going to be some kind of a writer. It just took me a lot longer to get published than I thought. But I began my political work as a teenager within the mid-70s with Mark Lane's Citizens Committee of Inquiry. Mark Lane was the most famous critic of the Warren Report. He wrote Rush to Judgment. So the JFK assassination is my wheelhouse issue still. It's what got me started down these rabbit holes. It forms a hidden history, has a lot of material in it, and so that a lot of things, but the majority, or there's more about the JFK assassination than any other subject in there. So it talks about my own work into it and kind of an overall thing as well. But after discovering what happened with the JFK assassination, that they could kill the president and get away with it, and the media would lie constantly about it, opened my eyes, turned me from a far left wing member of the ACLU to more of a populist. And I started, studying right-wing stuff like the Council of Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers, and Bohemian Grove, and all those conspiracies. And I started realizing, wow, this is really a huge mess, and we're run by really evil people. So I started going down, and again, I described that hidden history, things like Waco, Oklahoma City, 9/11, certainly, and all that. And to today, I mean, I just analyze things as I see them, and a lot of people can't figure out if I'm right or left or not, but this is my primary occupation now, is to kind of analyze what's going on politically and culturally. And there's never any lack of things to write or talk about.
Yeah, so many things. And one of the reasons I reached out to you is because I'm a huge history nerd. And a couple of weeks ago, I landed near Charlotte, North Carolina. And I went house hunting down in South Carolina, and, there's a lot of Revolutionary War historic places down there, especially near Camden area. I stopped by James Polk's home where apparently he was born and raised. And, being of Mexican American heritage, I have studied the U.S.-Mexican War in depth, and yep. I remember, I think that was one of the first times I really questioned history, was when I went through the history books. They portrayed that whole incident as a friendly exchange of money for land. And I'm like, and they didn't even call it a war. In the history book that I read, it was called the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. They completely ignored the war part. And I'm like, this is 100% horseshit. And yeah. When I went to that museum, I had a interaction with, the man that, the historian that was in charge of that little museum. It wasn't a huge museum by any means. It was a small thing, but I think I caught him off guard. He didn't realize how much I had gone down a lot of these rabbit holes. And it took him aback when I told him, look, I love history. I've studied. I'm a huge nerd, but I don't know how much of it is actually true. There's so much propaganda. It's hard to decipher what really did happen and what didn't. So I heard you on our mutual friend Billy Ray's show, and I think you it was you, Billy Ray, and John Hankey, and you guys were hitting old time history stuff, and I was like, oh man, I really need to get both of y'all. I did have John Hankey, and that was an interesting conversation. But I wanted to ask you some of these older hidden American history topics that a lot of people maybe they know just a little bit of, but haven't really taken the plunge. A few months back, I did a audiobook by David McGowan on the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, and that one was super fascinating to me. I never knew how many.
I love Dave McGowan. Yeah, Dave McGowan's the great. He's been compared with me a lot. Died way too soon. Unfortunately, we're just starting to make contact with each other. But you should, if you haven't read Crimes and Cover-ups in American Politics, 1776-1963, that's my follow-up to Hidden History. It has an introduction by Ron Paul. That I go into a lot of this stuff. I touch a little on the U.S.-Mexican War, but my upcoming book, which is coming out in August, which is basically Hidden History 3, but we're calling it American Memory Hole, How the Court Historians Promote Disinformation. It has a lot more on Polk. It has a lot about the U.S.-Mexican War. And you're right, it was, and ironically, because I start with Lincoln on most of this stuff. I say, you know, he set the precedence, his generals set the precedence with the total war and scorched earth policy. But there was really some of that going on in U.S.-Mexico. And I described some of the things of the kind of familiar unfortunate atrocities we see there. We saw in the Civil War, we see all the way to Guantanamo Bay, we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan, lots of raping, lots of looting, stealing, lots of, doing nasty things to civilians. And it even goes back farther, actually a little bit of that to the Indians, you know, during the Revolutionary War period. So it's terrible to write that, but it is what it is. And I very much have written critically about La Raza and groups like that. And but, you know, when you study this thing, in that case, it really was a theft of land. It didn't seem to make any sense. And so they have a point. And I don't agree with their politics. But and Polk, by the way, is like all war presidents. He's rated pretty high by the court historians. You can just look at the ratings of the presidents, and any president that presided over a war is always ranked higher. I mean, I don't know that George W. Bush will be, but virtually all of them are. So Lincoln, FDR, Wilson, which I consider the three worst presidents, they're generally considered the three best presidents. But Polk is up there as well. And it's only because he presided over the war with Mexico, which was really our first, you know, actual step over the line and outside, completely outside the Constitution was the Spanish-American War in 1898, because that was when we first went outside the United States off land now. But the U.S. war with Mexico, we did go outside because we went into territory that was outside the United States at that time. So we had a precedent of doing that. And I'll show in American Memory Hole how, especially under the Wilson administration, we were invading these countries back then. We invaded Mexico like 12 times during the Wilson administration. We invaded Haiti. We invaded the Dominican Republic, Philippines, a place. And you see the familiar atrocities there. So this, what we see today is precedent. It was fine. It was refined and perfected under Lincoln's generals. And that's why in the Crimes and Cover-ups, I have tons of anecdotal accounts from people who saw what they did in terms of raping almost every slave woman they could find. They raped. They didn't rape as many white women, but they raped lots of slave women. They burned crops. They burned down houses. They salted and oiled fields so that people couldn't grow food in their places. Just horrible, atrocious stuff that was beyond the pale in the history of warfare. And it's important. That's why I call it Hidden History, because we need to know our history, and there's a lot in it that we should be ashamed of.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I mean, And it's funny because you'll talk about these things and people are like, well, you're just anti-American. I'm like, why is it that I can't point at these atrocities? And you have to understand a lot of these things to get the bigger picture, you know, unless you want to live in a bubble where, you know, everything is just fine and dandy. And that's just not simply the case. And I think a lot of people are waking up, especially during the COVID era. But I did want to ask you a little bit about, have you done any research into the Nuremberg conspiracy?
The Nuremberg or Nuremberg?
No, Nuremberg.
Nuremberg. No, I'm not sure.
Yeah,
if you're,
no. Tell so me about the it. Nuremberg. I was hoping you would know something because every time I bring it up, no one knows. They've never heard about it. Nuremberg is Newburgh, and George Washington's headquarters was in Nuremberg, but I believe it actually took place in Windsor. But when I always like to look at origins, where does a lot of these origins come from? And when I've gone down to verifiable conspiracies, the Nuremberg conspiracy is probably the first one in quote unquote American history. And essentially what had happened was right after the Revolutionary War, the soldiers weren't getting paid and they were getting pissed off. And they were getting pissed off and people were worried that they may revolt. And so everything that had been fought for a few years earlier had been for naught.
Yeah.
But then we are told that George Washington gave this glorious speech that made everyone cry in the room and united everyone. But a lot of the mutiny is attributed, is what historians say, is through a letter, a very well-written letter that was circling around trying to, you know, basically propaganda, trying to get everyone riled up, instigated. And a lot of people think Alexander Hamilton was behind that letter.
Well, I don't remember the Nuremberg name, but I touch on some of this because there's evidence that Alexander Hamilton may have been an early day troll. He was actually like taking on an identity and writing to the papers and everything way before the internet. But you're talking about, I think, what led to, and I covered this in Crimes and Covers, went to the Shays Rebellion and Whiskey Rebellion.
It's tied to the Whiskey Rebellion. And like I said, it's just you see these things perpetuated over and over. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the Lincoln assassination. I did a show on it and I compared so many, from my point of view, so many things that happened in the Lincoln assassination that you can see in some modern day conspiracies. I mean, there's a lot of weird similarities to the Kennedy assassination, no question, but you can also see 9/11 similarities. You can even see Jeff Epstein similarities to the Lincoln assassination. One of those being how, Joseph Parker was supposed to be, you know, guarding Abraham Lincoln, and he got drunk, kind of like the prison guards that fell asleep that were supposed to be watching Jeff Epstein.
Right.
So one of the things that I keep noticing with a lot of these events that people have questions and have conspiratorial thinking is because you see the same things happening over and over again. When you've looked into the Abraham Lincoln assassination, in a nutshell, for those that probably haven't heard my other shows, it wasn't just the assassination of Abraham Lincoln for this conspiracy. There were other people due to be hit, like Edwin Stanton, Seward, and Vice President Johnson. They were on that hit list, similar to 9/11 simultaneous attacks. But, you know, and also similar in 9/11, how Larry Silverstein decided to get a haircut on the morning of 9/11. Ulysses S. Grant decided to not show up that day. And so many interesting things. When you look at the Lincoln assassination, what are some of the key takeaways that you get?
Well, I devoted a chapter to the Lincoln assassination and crimes and cover-ups. I talked a lot about it. I have researched it a lot. And, you know, although I was persuaded, you know, by reading Dave McGowan's work on it, because Dave was working on it at the time he died. I'm not sure where he was going with it, but I got the impression that he was almost trying to say that the Lincoln assassination was a hoax. That's the impression I got, you know, because he was questioning a lot of elements about it, about the
attack on the Seward Mansion. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There was, it was very, I mean, there, a lot of
Mary Todd Lincoln.
Yeah. Well, and the implausibility, like having the professional photographer come on board and take what looked like Hollywood snapshots of the conspirators, especially Louis Payne, who was a big, strapping, good looking guy. And he's posed almost like he's an actor. And so it made me look at things in a different way. But certainly, you know, people that have studied the Lincoln assassination know, you mentioned Parker, John F. Parker, who was you know, apparently hired, recommended for the job by Mary Todd Lincoln herself. I mean, we found information about that, which is kind of strange because she was very critical of him afterwards. But Parker had a very checkered past. He had a record of falling asleep and being drunk on the job over to go. Nothing much ever happened to him. And somehow he found himself as the only protection for Lincoln that night. And as you note, we're unsure. Some stories say he went next door to the bar and got drunk. Others claimed he moved his seat down to a spot better where he could see the play. But at any rate, he wasn't outside the door to protect him. And so that's the first thing, is that and then you noted about Grant. And I started out my chapter on the assassination by talking about all the people. And Otto Eisenschimmel, who was the first, he was like the Mark Lane of the Lincoln assassination. And he wrote a couple of great books on the Lincoln assassination. And he was, you know, not popular at all for doing it, but and he was smeared, as I put like some quotes about the establishment, what they said about him. I guess he was just telling the truth. But they what you first notice is that no one wanted to go with Lincoln to the theater. I mean, it thinks, you know, it was bad enough Grant didn't want to go, and Grant begged off and claimed he had to go see his children. I go into this theory made no sense with the train ride and everything. People can read it in my book, but clearly it was just an excuse. And, you know, the war had just ended. This is something of a victory celebration. And I must note, as a Catholic, I still understand this happened on a Good Friday. So, and those were more religious times. So it's kind of strange that, first of all, there was a play going on Good Friday, and that the president decided to go out that way. But again, I go into Lincoln's alleged religious beliefs in the chapter on Lincoln. And Lincoln was almost certainly an atheist. And there's evidence that he actually rewrote the Bible to his liking when he was a young man and had to burn it when his political career started. But so Lincoln has a lot of a lot of strange skeletons in his background, but he couldn't get anybody to go with him. He had Stanton begged off. He had an aide to Stanton, who was the Secretary of War, said, "No, he can't come. I have something for him to do." So it's
Eckert, right?
Eckert, yeah, Thomas Eckert, yep. And who Lincoln was enamored of because he could break an iron bar over his arms or something. So Lincoln liked him. But Speaker of the House, Schuyler Colfax, begged off. So all these people turned him down. Again, this was a victory celebration for the Union. Very strange for all these people not to want to be part of it. And none of them did so in religious reasons and said, you know, what the hell are you doing going to the theater on a Good Friday? Nobody said that. So I'm not sure, but that tells you something, I think. And so that's the first strange element. And then there, I talk about the strange telegram that Lincoln got during the show. And we still don't know the details on that. And I go into the details about it. There's so many elements of this. There's John Wilkes Booth, the calling card. He left a calling card.
He left several calling cards.
Yes, he did. But he left.
Kind of like, you know, the hijackers leaving passports and a paper. Exactly. It's like he was leaving a paper trail. Is what exactly. I came out of.
Yeah, and he left a card for Andrew Johnson, the vice president, saying, "Don't wish to disturb you. Are you in J. Wilkes Booth?" I mean, just, you know, again, what was so again, it's very hard. We know that Mary Todd Lincoln later suspected Andrew Johnson. I'm kind of all over the place with Johnson, but because Johnson was pretty much a drunk, and as you noted, there were other people. Louis Payne was supposed to attack Secretary of State William Seward. He went to the house, and Dave McGowan goes into that. I refer everybody to his work, Center for an Informed America. Still, he goes into.
I have his audiobook on my. I voiced over the entire audiobook on my on my channels. So if anyone's interested, the audiobook version.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful! Yeah, because that he again, I don't know where he was going with it, because he got sick and he died, and he was kind of he's more than half the.
Yeah, it leaves you hanging at the end, and that's really the only bummer, because I think David McGowan, you know, was great at pointing out some of the most, in hindsight, it looks simple shit. I'm like, oh, damn, how did I not catch that? But right. he points them out to show the absurdity, because he's in David McGowan's piece, he's constantly tearing down Swanson. What was it? John Swanson. He's noted as the quote unquote premier Abraham Lincoln assassination author, James Swanson, yeah. James Swanson.
Okay.
And he wrote the book Manhunt, and David McGowan spends quite a bit criticizing it. And as a matter of fact, recently, I think it's on Netflix, they've adapted James Swanson's Manhunt into like a mini TV series. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you heard about that, but I watched the episode, and when you listen to David McGowan break it down, and then you watch this episode, you see how much baloney and how much Hollywood is in it. I mean, they make Edwin Stanton seem like he was a great friend of Lincoln and just a good guy. But Edwin Stanton was a guy that exhumed one of his dead daughters.
Yes, he did.
And just her house, had her chilling in his room. Yeah. Like,
he was a very strange guy. And he was the reason, again, I go, if you people need to read my book, though, read the book on, Honest Abe, you know, which by the way, most of the historical record indicates he was given the name Honest Abe the way you'd call a bald man curly or a fat guy slim, because it was a characteristic he clearly didn't have, and it was so well known they called him on. So he was anything but honest, and he was a shill for the railroads. He was a corporate lawyer. This is a guy who represented, this is the great emancipator. He represented slave owners trying to track down their runaway slaves. He didn't represent the runaway slaves. He represented the slave owners always. And so he was consistent in that. So he was anything but what they portrayed him to be. So this guy's, I think, the greatest tyrant we've ever had. But be that as it may, at that time, the radical Republicans, that they called them, were just an insane bunch. And Stanton and Seward, I mean, Seward had a bell on his desk he used to brag about, that he could ring it and have any man arrested in America for any reason at all at his whim. And he used to show all the visitors that. So this is, and it draws parallels to what we're seeing today, because we're almost to that point now where they might as well have a bell on their desk where they can arrest anybody for any reason. But that started with them. And Stanton, as you noticed, was a psychotic. Eisenschimmel thought Stanton was the architect of the conspiracy to kill Lincoln. I agree with him. I think most of the evidence points to him. All the evidence went through him. He's the one that put out a wanted poster of Edwin Booth, John Wilkes Booth's brother. Originally, instead of John, when John Wilkes Booth was, as a community college professor near me once said, you know, John Wilkes Booth was tantamount to Brad Pitt in his day. He was a very famous celebrity. So everybody knew who he was. Everybody knew who the suspect was, because he often acted at Ford's Theater. So when he ran across the stage, they all knew it was him. So it was no clear. And then, of course, you had the fact when he fled that a couple key points were out of the city were left open for him that were usually closed. They let him pass by. The Lincoln conspiracy, which was made into kind of a glitzy 1977 film, but has some good stuff in it, postulated that Booth escaped. And we've had Finus L. Bates that did that later. That Finus L. Bates, who, by the way, is the direct ancestor of Kathy Bates, the famous actress, by the way. Finus L. Bates wrote that he was the first one to postulate that Booth didn't die till like 1904 or something. In fact, there was a mummy that circulated around the country in sideshows that claimed to be John Wilkes Booth's real mummy. So we don't know what happened, but we know that the body that was supposedly burned inside Garrett's barn almost certainly wasn't Booth's. But during when I was writing Crimes and Cover-Ups, one of the people I talked to several times was John Wilkes Booth's great, 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 great niece or something, who has since, by the way, deleted me from Facebook. I guess it was probably over Trump or COVID or something. I don't know. But she was nice at that time. And Booth had no direct ancestors that we know of. He may have had kids because he was a playboy, but none that he claimed responsibility for. He there's a lot of doubt as to who is buried in Green Mount Cemetery in Baltimore under his name. A lot of people think, okay, they've been trying to exhume his body for a long time. And typically the family is the one who determines whether a body can be exhumed. Now, his family wants the body exhumed. Park Service blocks it. they won't let it happen because again, even something like that. Now, you know, if that proved to not be John Wilkes Booth's body, it's not earth shattering for today's politics, but again, it's one of those dominoes that shows, wow, they put a lot of time and effort in that. Like the historian you mentioned and people like that, they poo-pooed, they made fun of these people. It turns out the crazy conspiracy theorists were right. Because then you have to explain, okay, well, wait a minute, who was there then? Why did the people on board the Montauk where his body was, why did they lie about it? Even though they actually didn't at first, they had the doctor was saying there's one of the doctors said there's no two. I've never seen two body people that were more different than John Wilkes Booth in this body. So it definitely was not his red hair.
It's kind of like Osama bin Laden, you know, like David McGowan says, you know, the death of Osama bin Laden. Hey, we're told that they killed him and they threw his body off board, you know, in Muslim tradition. And
Muslim tradition. Yeah, yeah. They're well known for that. Yeah, I mean, just absolute bullshit. But so that's an example of how they could, you know, you could shut the conspiracy theorists up, but they won't do it. It's the same reason I actually talked to you going back even farther, Meriwether Lewis. You're talking about going back to the early 1800s. Really a death that would have no impact on today's politics. But I talked to his great nephew or something, because again, he had no kids. And they've been trying to get his body exhumed for years too, because they don't think he killed himself. They think he was murdered. So, and again, but the Park Service blocks it. Typically, any family can get a body exhumed, except in cases like this where it might solve a historical mystery. So so that's where we are in terms of, but there's tons of it. And I have a lot of the evidence for conspiracy in my chapter in the book. And like I said, I would urge people to read McGowan's work. Because as McGowan points out, you know, because most people think when they hear about it, there was a conspiracy to kill Lincoln. The government tried conspirators. I don't think any of them were actual conspirators, but that's who they tried. And they hanged Mary Surratt, the last woman to be hanged. You know, and she was, you know, a middle-aged woman who was unquestionably totally innocent. She ran the rooming house where Booth rented a room, and that was the extent of her involvement. They hanged her. Shocking that people at the end thought they're going to hang her too. They hung David Harold, who was feeble-minded, as he used to say in the day. He was kind of, I guess you would call him a fan of John Wilkes Booth, who followed him around and kind of worshipped him. He wasn't guilty of anything. I don't think he was involved in any. George Acerot, who lost his nerve, as they say, and was a bit of a drunk. He was supposed to, I think, kill Johnson. He didn't do it. And then Lewis Payne, who was the big strapping guy who looked like a movie star. Who
beats up everyone but doesn't have a scratch on his and awesome pictures. And
can't kill the feeble, incapacitated old William Seward.
Yeah.
And somehow stabs him like, I don't know how many times he did. It made no sense. And
I've heard these historians talk about that, and the way they spinned it is, it had me in stitches. They say that when Payne was stabbing Seward, that Seward wrapped himself in sheets and was rolling around. And yeah, so just, every time Payne was stabbing at him, he was missing, ole, ole.
It's comical. So it's so comical. It's completely ridiculous. And you have to picture.
For questioning the ridiculousness of it. That's what makes it even funny.
Yeah. And that's what you have to believe ridiculous things to believe conventional history. I mean, you mentioned the magical passport of 9/11 that flies down on top of the rubble. The everything else is obliterated into dust and metal and no, not that.
The black boxes. The black boxes get destroyed, but the passport everything, is but
not that passport. And then you have the the single bullet in the JFK assassination, which it took me forever to realize. Of course, I know it couldn't have done it, but I said, you know, wait a minute, why? Why would sophisticated conspirators, why wouldn't they plan a bullet that they'd shot into something so it looked like it hit something? Yeah. I mean, but they did it on a purpose. I call them calling cards. And they're to let you know, we did this. You know, what are you going to do about it? You know, we don't care. You know, so it's like, and that's and
kind of to mock people that really know.
Yeah. They're like, you know, Jack the Ripper sent taunting letters to Scotland Yard. It's basically they have the mentality of a Jack the Ripper. They're a serial killer of mentalities, but these are.
Well, didn't McGowan tie someone to the Tumblety to the Jack the Ripper murders?
Well, Tumblety is, he may have, I don't agree with him there. I think that I've studied Jack the Ripper a lot. And I think clearly it was the only thing that explains why today, you know, the murders happened in 1888, the murders of maybe six, we're just not sure, five, six London prostitutes in 1888. They're still covering up and they're still classified files related to that today. Mm. Now, if you can, you come up with the reason why, you know, 100 and almost 140 years later, and they actually, Scotland Yard actually says this is to protect sources. Sources? 140 years later? So, I mean, then this is, so obviously, you know, Stephen Knight, I believe, got it right. And I think he died very young because he got it right. He wrote Jack the Ripper, The Final Solution. And if you've seen the movie From Hell with Johnny Depp, which is a really good representation, that's based mostly on Knight's work. But, and it's very bold. Because it specifically, you know, shows Freemasonic rituals and it ties the Freemasons of England into it. And his theory was based on the royal family, the Duke of Clarence, getting a girl pregnant and the whole about the cover up about that, you know, and basically it involved Sir William Gull, who was the main ripper, who was the surgeon. And that's why you saw the precise marks and, you know, removing organs and stuff like that. And the people, you know, that had to have anatomical knowledge. They said, so that's the kind of thing where even there, where you see something that really doesn't appear to have a political reason, but you know, when something's covered up for that long, there's some political reason. In that case there, it was the murders were tied to the royal family and they were tied to Freemasonry. And Stephen Knight wrote that book. And then he wrote a book called The Brotherhood, about the power of Freemasonry in England. And he died before it was published, like 40 years old or something. So, you know, again, my spidey sense goes off whenever I hear that. And yeah. I personally think that's what the Jack the Ripper, you know, murders were about, that they were tied to Freemasonry.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, even going back to the Lincoln assassination, the amount of people that were Freemasons involved in the assassination. And then one of the interesting characters that doesn't get talked about a lot is John Surratt, which is Mary Surratt's son. He was labeled as the second highest co-conspirator. And yet all the lesser ones were hung immediately, wholly unconstitutionally. And then this guy gets to flee everywhere he wanted to. He goes to Rome and becomes a papal zouave.
Yes, he does.
And then when they know about it, the American authorities know about him, and for whatever reason, David McGowan points this out, they keep delaying his extradition. And kind of what he gets at is, you know, under military tribunals, they set their own rules, and they were going to get guilty verdicts no matter what. But if, you know, in the case of John Surratt, it was going to be harder to rig, you know, any quote unquote justice against him. And he survived for a long time. And apparently he burned his autobiography that, you know, talked about the assassination. It, just like Robert Todd Lincoln burned all of the papers connected to his dad's father right before he died. It's interesting shit that you don't hear a lot of these mainline historians ever really address or talk about.
Right. And you're right. Surratt was really the number two, basically, in whatever conspiracy they were trying to cook up. John Surratt would have been. Instead, his mother gets hanged. He doesn't come back to save her. And you're right, but he eventually comes back to the United States and becomes a noted lecturer on the Lincoln assassination. He gives lectures about it. I mean, it's like, what? It's like, so, I mean, try to figure that out. But that's, you know, and Robert Todd Lincoln is the only Lincoln that lives to be fat and happy and lives to an old age and becomes a really, you know, I guess you would call him a rhino of his day or something. I mean, he is
what a weird.
Yeah.
I mean, when you, this is where I kind of tie a lot of Epstein stuff in it, in that, you know, Epstein hung out with Bill Clinton and Donald Trump, and he hung out with everyone. Mm-hmm. And when you go back there, you see Robert Todd Lincoln getting saved by John Wilkes Booth's brother, Edwin Booth, from falling into the train tracks.
And then
crazy enough, John Wilkes Booth is having relations with Robert Todd Lincoln is having relations with John Wilkes Booth's fiance.
I haven't heard that one.
Yes. Okay. It was a love triangle. And then the other weird anomaly, again, what are the odds of this? Abraham Lincoln dies on the bed where John Wilkes Booth used to sleep in. I mean, what are the
odds? I didn't know that either. You've heard things I haven't heard. The Peterson house. I mean, I guess he could have stayed there. I have not heard that. There's so many.
Yeah, it's kind of wild. I mean, one of the things that one of my original things that I've come up recently, I live in Venice, Florida, and so in Sarasota, there's so many 9/11 connections out here. You had Venice or Muhammad Atta.
So the flying school was.
Flying school. Yeah. Then you had the Royal Saudis mentioned in the 28 pages report living out here. And then 15 minutes away from there, George Bush was here on the morning of 9/11. And within walking distance of that elementary school, you had Muhammad Atta's favorite strip club. What are the odds of all this stuff happening? Yeah. I mean, it's pretty bizarre how, and you know, you mentioned it to normies. Oh yeah, that's just a coincidence. Like they think, yeah. I'm like, how many more goddamn coincidences does one need?
Exactly. I mean, coincidences happen, but I mean, you see the same pattern in all of these events. And again, even going back as far as the Lincoln assassination, as opposed to the Kennedy assassination, whatever. But you see these. I mean, I've really. As I try to plumb through all these things, you know, for my books, my hidden history books, and I don't think I've found one event or that has been portrayed accurately. I mean, it's always a narrative that makes no sense. There's more often than not, there are a lot of unnatural deaths associated with it where people are knocked off to keep them quiet. Evidence is destroyed. Evidence is missing. Key evidence. In the face of, you know, for instance, the JFK assassination, nobody knows where JFK's brain is. I mean, can you believe that? I tell people that. It's like, how is that even possible? I mean, have you ever heard of anybody, any, you know, more losing the brain of anyone, a vagrant, the biggest derelict you've ever seen that had no connections or anybody, and they lost his, I'd never heard of that, but the president of the United States. But I, you know, when I was writing Hidden History, I found an amazing Secret Service memo. And the agent talked about how JFK's brain was destroyed in a food processor. Now this, if you can figure that out. Now in my upcoming book, American Memory Hole. Since then, I've done more research on it. And while I was technically right, it was a rather large piece of his brain. But it was destroyed in a food processor with no explanation. And again, if you can figure out what the rationale of that can't be standard operating procedure. What you know, what
JFK is sandwiches for all, everyone gather around.
Yeah. I mean, what, you know, so it's like, but those are the kind of things you see. And it's like, there's no coincidence. There's no way to attribute them to coincidence. There's no innocent way to explain them, but that's, you know, I never run out of things to write with. I mean, in the American Memory Hole, I just found out so many amazing things about, and again, thanks to, I have researchers, Chris Graves and Peter Seacott, who did so much work for me. And it's they really helped me out, because it's, since I wrote my first Hidden History, I was able to do all that on my own easily. I could use the search engines. I could use Google most of the time back then, find what I needed. Now, every search engine is controlled. Mm. They all use a Google algorithm. They know what you're trying to look for, and they block you from finding it. You have to go backdoor. And I need those guys, because they're really good at it, to find out what you need. But I mean, we were able to find, a lot of times you have to go to old books because the internet just won't happen anymore. But we know that when I was finding out some of the things, for instance, that happened under Wilson, which were incredible, all the, you know, the foreign interventionism that we did, which not generally known to people. And, but one of the most amazing things, when they invaded Haiti, keep in mind, Haiti's an all black population. They invaded Haiti. And at that time, Franklin Roosevelt was the Assistant Secretary of War. And one of the first great chicken hawks, you know, he wasn't going to go anywhere near the field of battle, but he supported every war he could. I mean, just like the ones you see today, it's the same story. They don't go anywhere near the field of battle, but they love war and they support every war. And that was FDR. But he went over there during the invasion with one of his friends, one of his well-connected friends. And there's this information out there that talks, they had an idea. FDR, the great liberal president, president to be, they wanted to start their own plantation in Haiti. Plantation. Now, what are they going to do? Were they going to feed them watermelon and have them sing Swing Low, Sweet Chariot? I mean, what is that? And but that's what they want. And not only that, I have a quote from the guy who was with Roosevelt that was admiring like the thighs or something, much as Jimmy the Greek would do later on one of the officials in the Haitian government said, oh, that's how we used to breed them, you know, bred them, you know, for, and it's like what we consider a tremendous racist remark. FDR later used to use that as like a joke during his state dinners. He would joke about it. So, I mean, these are the kind of things that you see, and it's like, wow, is it, you know, can this be possible? I found out things like when we talk about everybody knows the Japanese were interred in camps during World War II by Roosevelt. But what is not, and I touched on this in earlier books, that there were German Americans and Italian Americans too. Not as many, but they were, and they didn't get any reparations. But I found in this, doing further research, they not only interred these people, they stole everything they had. They confiscated all their property in an early asset forfeiture thing. So they took their homes. They took their businesses. The German Americans alone that they locked up had businesses worth billions of dollars. They stole them. They took them. And, you know, when they let them out eventually, they never got their property back. Their business, they stole their businesses. They stole their homes. And only the Japanese got reparations for decades later. But I mean, these are the kind of things when you tell people, they give you a look. It's like, you know, do you realize how wrong that is? That's theft. But again, the theft part goes back to, and again, it's important to go back, especially under Lincoln in Crimes and Cover-Ups. I published an amazing letter, one of the most amazing letters in American history, by a guy named Lieutenant Myers, and he was a Union soldier. And he's bragging to his family, he's writing home to his family, and he's kind of bragging about how much booty they've gotten, how much property they've stolen on Sherman's march to the South. And he's complaining because General Sherman is the head of the grifting. He's the head of the graft, and Sherman's getting a cut of everything. And he's complaining. He said, yeah, you know, we have to give a cut to the officers. He said, General Sherman alone has gotten enough gold and silver to start his own bank. And so I'm saying that they're confessing to massive. So again, what does that have to do with war? Why are you raping the slave women? Why are you stealing all the property that's left there, the jewelry and the valuables? Why are you burning the crops so they can't eat? In many cases, they killed all the horses and piled up in big piles. There were so many atrocities the Union troops committed, and these were the good guys. And if you look, I'm sorry, there's nothing the Confederates did that are on a par with countless crimes that the Union committed. And so again, that's why, you know, that doesn't mean you support slavery, but it is what it is. The people you think were the good guys were thieves, rapists. They murdered people. Even if they didn't do it directly, they murdered them by destroying their shelter, destroying their crops. So they had nothing. There's no way they could make it. And keep in mind, every male pretty much was in the Confederate Army. So these were kids. These were old people. And it's disgraceful. But again, those are, you know, as I say all the time, history is written by the victors.
Yeah, every single time. And that's why it's so hard to believe any of it. I mean, one interesting little piece that I came across in that Polk Museum was this right here. You see that on the screen?
Yeah. 1828, yeah.
Yeah, so for those listening in audio format, this is 1828. Andrew Jackson defeats Adams. On the so-called corrupt bargain, supporters of Andrew Jackson were able to paint the incumbent president as less than honest. During the campaign, the Republican Party split into two camps. Jackson supporters became Democratic Republicans, or simply the Democrats. Adams supporters became the National Republicans. Jackson won in a landslide, and his election ushered in the age of the common man. I think so. When I read that, I've had that thought for a long time, that both Republicans and Democrats, it's the same shit. They may spew some things that sound a little different, but it's the same damn thing. They all bow down to the wall with their little hats at the end of the damn day. And there you have it. This is from the James Polk Museum. where you're talking about the, you know, at one point the Republicans and Democrats were the same damn thing.
Yes.
Two wings of the same tyrannical bird is how some people would put it.
Yeah, exactly right. And, you know, Jackson is one of those figures that I have mixed feelings about, because and he was, by many indications, he was a populist, and I'm a populist. I love the way he invited the common riffraff to his, you know, his celebration after he's elected, and how they all Washington was outraged that these average people were muddying the carpets with their work boots, and, you know, they supposedly stuck their hands in the punch bowl. All these things that they, because he was the common riffraff. They've never been invited to the White House. So I love that stuff because I'm a populist. And Jackson fought the central bank. You know, he took up I think that's what he wanted on his tomb, you know, that he fought the banks or something. So a lot of good things there, but he was also, you know, loved war way too much for my taste. And
Feelings the same, because, I mean, on the one hand, he ended the Federal Reserve, which was awesome. Mm-hmm. But having indigenous blood in my veins, he was also the pusher of the Indian Removal Act.
Yes, he was. Yeah.
And I've just come to the conclusion that all these guys, all of them, they can do some good things here and there. You can point good things, but they also do terrible shit because they're all puppets at the end of the day. I mean, Polk was they called Andrew Jackson Old Hickory, and James Polk was an underling of his, and they called him Young Hickory, which is very interesting. It just shows that the line gets continued. Have you done any research into President Garfield?
Oh yeah. I in Crimes and Cover-Ups, I talked about his assassination. Again, he had some quotes on the record about, I think it was banks. I get these things, but
The banks. Who controls the banks, or I'll find it here. But if you can give us a little taste of what you found out.
Garfield. Most people don't know he lingered for quite a while, and he was kind of like my boy Huey Long, my hero later, where probably was killed by medical neglect more than the assassination. Now, whether the excuse is they didn't know how to treat it then, I don't know if that's true or not. But Garfield. He basically was, what was the name of the, I forget the, they had a break off because, again, this was post-war. They all were Union men. Garfield was a Union officer. Like so many of these people were war heroes because everybody served in the Civil War back then, or you couldn't get elected to office. But he was, I forget what the break was. You might have it there that he was basically against the Tammany Hall. He was against what I forget the regulars or I can't forget what they had a name for them. And Garfield was more of a reformist, where he was he wanted to end that kind of spoil system. And so he was, you know, seemed to me from what you could read about him, a good guy. Maybe he had those comments about the banks, and certainly to be assassinated as he was. And again, I think that was Charles Guiteau, I think, was the guy that shot him. And he's the one that was reminded me a lot of Charles Manson. If you read about him, he was, you know, really kooky and was demanded to read a poem, "I'm Going to the Lordy" or something like that before they hanged him. But he was at his trial. He acted a lot like Manson. He was very out there and kind of, you know, making a spectacle of himself. And that really didn't have, again, just like any time they have somebody assassinated, it's never any kind of logical reason. It's always about, I think he was, I don't know if he was a disgruntled office seeker. I think he was, or he might've been mad at Garfield for being a reformer and, you know, liking the other side of the Republicans. I wrote this a while back, but I analyzed it pretty thoroughly in Crimes and Cover-Ups. And there's a lot of crossover. Sometimes I get that mixed up with the McKinley assassination, which had a lot of the same kind of elements, but yeah, Garfield. Yeah. I don't know what would have happened if he had lived, but he didn't. Well, and who knows?
Well, here's one of his one of my favorite quotes of his. This is by James A. Garfield. "Whoever controls the volume of money in our country is absolute master of all industry and commerce."
Yeah.
"When you realize that the entire system is very easily controlled, one way or another, by a few powerful men at the top, you will not have to be told how periods of inflation and depression originate." Holy smokes.
Yeah.
And you know, the interesting thing about President Garfield is how he was shot, but he didn't die right there and then.
Yeah, I said, yeah, he was
hospitalized, and it sounds like he died due to medical malpractice. Yeah, that's so they what I wanted said, yeah. the son of a bitch dead. Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
No, and that's why I said he died of that, very much like Huey Long, my boy later. He was my all-time hero, who was almost certainly died by medical neglect rather than assassination. But shooting him opened the door to that, and unfortunately, Garfield, like, I mean, even somebody like William Henry Harrison, who was our shortest-lived president, I found the quote from that guy that, yeah, I mean, he served 32 days. And so you always wonder what the hell happened there. And they claimed he was out, you know, he got caught a cold on the inauguration. There's stories that never make any sense. But at any rate, I found a quote from this guy. I found the only quote you could find on him. And it was amazing. And it just said something like, after a lifetime in politics, I've come to the conclusion that all practical politics revolves around making the rich richer and the poor poor. I thought, wow, that's an eternal truth. You know, and is that why he only lasted 32 days? I don't know. So when these guys die unnaturally like that, it always gets my attention. And but I don't know anything more about Garfield than that.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, I know you have to run. So is there any other thing that you want to leave us with? Or I would love to do this again, because I think it sure, was real short, and I really enjoyed this, Mr. Jeffries. But
there's so much, man. I mean, I certainly, yeah. Especially when American Memory Hole comes out, because you're gonna find so much in there you're not gonna believe. It's gonna blow your mind.
I will be reading your book, sir. Yeah, 100%.
Really, but I mean, I would say that what we're seeing now. I talk, I write on Substack too. So people, it's the only place I'm not shadow banned. Donald Jeffries at Substack.com. It's called I Protest, like my podcast. And I'm writing one now on, I'll be finishing it today or tomorrow, on this Anti-Semitism Awareness Act that was just passed by Congress. I think it's the most dangerous piece of legislation ever passed in this country. That's saying something. Yeah. I mean, this really... There's no two ways about it. It solidifies, because, you know, I hear from so many people that follow me. So many of them are obsessed with the Jews and all that. But I mean, this really, it's going to give those people red meat, because I don't know how you look at legislation like this any other way than this was Jewish pressure, because this is something. It's 320-91. It wasn't a close vote. Both Democrats and Republicans voted for it. If you look at what's in that bill, it basically makes denying the Holocaust a crime, as it is all around the world. So that bridges the free, because again, there's so many peripheral issues around that. I avoided the Holocaust and crimes and cover-ups because I know how explosive that subject is. But you could, they may extend that. Well, you know, you're disputing the narrative of World War II. You know, you can't do that. And it talks about make any inferences about that way Israel was created was improper. You can't say they're a racist nation. And more importantly, Christians, from a Christian standpoint, it could make parts of the New Testament anti-Semitic, because it says you can't say the Jews killed Christ. So St. Paul said that. So, I mean, I don't know. And again, being raised a Catholic.
But do you think that's by design, though, like knowing damn well, like that's red meat for certain folks? It could be part of the plan for it to do that, in that it's always like there are several steps ahead of the game, and I agree with you. It would set a dangerous precedent. I had a Holocaust debate on my Odyssey channel. I didn't put it on my podcast player because I didn't know if it would get taken down or with anything like that. So I had it on my Odyssey channel. So if this goes to law, am I a thought criminal?
Well, yeah, that's and then,
you again, know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and there are two things about the act that really, first of all, anti-Semitism, that's what Candace Owens has been saying, is that anti-Semitism is never just like hate speech or racism or anything. It's how do you define it? Yeah. It's no concrete term. It's like you can't define it like saying that guy has blue eyes. Okay, that's quantifiable. But you can't say, okay, he's a racist. What does that mean? What do you mean? That's your opinion. There's no legal way to define that. And same thing with anti-Semitic. That's really messy, because Semitic people are past Palestinians and people in the Middle East as well. It's not even an accurate term. But yeah. So if you want to say anti-Jewish, well, that means, okay, well, you say you can't, are we going to criminalize people that are anti-anything else?
Christian? Like, yeah. There's penalties for being anti-Christian.
Right, right. So there's, yeah. you can't.
And I would argue Christians are more diverse ethnically. You have African yeah. Christians. You have
sure.
Latin America is mostly Christian.
Yes.
It's way more diverse, but you can't criticize that other religion when I would argue has mostly white folks. Everything yeah. is backwards.
Right. It is backward. And it's very, but it's just very, dang, because you can't, they're not only, they're not doing that. There's nothing, I didn't see anything in legislation. What is this bill? Is this going to be criminalized? What do you mean by this? Are you going to be prosecuted? Because that will be thought crime, as you said. And as a noted thought criminal of long repute, you know, I resent that because I don't want to go further down the rabbit hole because this is, people really have to understand how dangerous this is because this is, you can say, yeah, it's not, I don't think it's, it speaks well of somebody to just be prejudiced against a whole group of people. I don't generalize, but it's not against the law. It's not again, like that's if somebody says
speech,
right? Exactly. So if you say, you know, I really hate rednecks. That's why I don't go near trailer parks. Okay. Is that hate speech? No, it wouldn't be because you're talking about mostly white people. So it doesn't seem to cover them, but it's, you know, you have the right to do that, but you know, we can't say something like, or you're already getting that into the fat acceptance movement saying, well, I'm not attracted to fat women or what? You know, I mean, or, you know, transgender. I'm sorry.
You're not attracted to trannies?
Yeah,
you're,
no, I don't want date trans. Exactly. I won't date. They have a tech. What do you mean? You're transphobe because you won't date trans women? Yeah. So this is where we're at. They haven't made legislation like that. This is, and this is why there's always so much talk about Jews and Jews' power, because they're 2% of the population and somebody got these congressmen to vote overwhelming for something that you'd think that, well, I don't know why this is even on their mind. It has nothing to do with our country. I think, as far as I know, it's the first time in the history of the world where one country's legislative body voted to make it illegal. And again, I don't know what the crime is, the penalties are going to be, illegal to criticize some other country. I don't think that's ever happened before. And this is, people should realize, wow, if you had the nerve to say that we're saying Israel has too much power and there's Zionist power, what is this? How do you explain this? And there's no other way to explain it. It is getting a lot of backlash and a lot of criticism. So I don't know what's happening there, but right now it's a very, very serious situation. And people ought to realize that, you know, if you can, I'm a free speech purist, I'm a civil libertarian. Unfortunately, most of Americans aren't now. But in this case, you see really how the right and left converged and said, no, there's no free speech on Israel, and there's no free speech on historical issues which may involve questions about Jews. And that's just, you can't have how do you say that they're forbidden areas to talk about? I mean, that's just, you can't do that. You can't say you can talk about everything but this. That's not free speech.
We're in a Orwellian times and everything is inverted, it seems like. Mr. Jeffries, where can people find you?
Again, DonaldJeffries@Substack.com is my Substack. I protest. It's the only place where I'm not being shadow banned. Try to give some love to Masking the Truth, How COVID-19 Destroyed Civil Liberties and Shut Down the World, the most shadow banned book in the world. Barnes & Noble disappeared the book. It's gone. Amazon disappeared the Kindle version. You can still go to my Substack and everything, and you can go to Jeff Rentz's site and have the links through Lulu and Midnight Rider News. You can still get the ebook that way, but try to give that book some love. It's the most important book on COVID, and that's why they're trying to stop it. My new book, American Memory Hole, is coming out in August, How the Court Historians Promote Disinformation, and that'll have all kinds of great stuff on everything from the founding of the Republic all the way through more about the assassination of JFK Jr., lots of 9/11, Oklahoma City, all kinds of good stuff.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, sir. I truly had a blast, and we definitely need to do a part two down the road.
Anytime, man. Just let me know.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir. Have a good one.
Okay, brother. Take care.
All right, you too. All right, y'all. That was the great and powerful Don Jeffries. Hope you guys enjoyed that. That was a brief down the rabbit hole. Had a shit tons of fun. Remember, we will be having Dr. Raz Vihari, 6 p.m. Eastern, talking all things moon landing. He was mentioned by Bart Sabrell on the Joe Rogan podcast, so that should be a banger of a show. Thank you guys all so much. Much love, hugs, and kisses to all.